This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to Pressing Matters, the show where we go behind the headlines and explore issues driving the press. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. 2020 has been a year colored by the global pandemic. In our last episode for the year, we're taking a look back at some of the compelling conversations we've had with journalists around the region in these unprecedented times. China became the first country to institute nationwide lockdowns in response to COVID-19 after the virus spread beyond the city of Wuhan, where it first originated early this year. In February, we spoke to journalist Caroline Khan about the situation on the ground in Beijing. What's it like on the streets? Are they relatively empty, or do people go around as normal but in lesser numbers?
I would say most people try to stay home if it is not urgent. Many employees have been working from home, big or small companies. If you are not in an urgent situation to get out, you don't. And of course, people have to go to the market to buy vegetables, buy food. But I think many families, they only go shopping once every few days to avoid more contact with people. I've been to several markets, local farmers markets, and I have seen several fightings because the managers of the markets stop people, anybody who's not wearing a mask. So they just stop you from getting in. And some people say, it's really difficult to get a mask now in Beijing, in China. You cannot buy it at any pharmacy shop. And most of the delivery service has been either interrupted or delayed, postponed.
How is public morale, after it's been almost a month of either self-imposed quarantine, or what's the mood of people like at the moment?
I think it's hard to say. I take my family, for example. I haven't seen any of my family members except for my parents and my brother since January. So we have been changing a lot of information in the WeChat group. And I think many of my family members, their day is spent getting up, and then it's lunchtime, then do some work, but not much, and then it's dinner time, and then watching news, and the news is quite disturbing. Every day you see, you listen to the latest number, how many people been infected and how many people dead. Your home is the only place you spend 24 hours in many days in a row. And my uncle was talking about this a few days ago, saying, well, if this doesn't stop, probably many people will end up having a mental illness. Well, he was joking, but not totally joking,
Caroline also weighed in on the media landscape in China and whether the pandemic is creating greater public awareness over the need for free and independent media. How do people feel about the censorship that they know is happening? Is it seen as a fact of life and is generally accepted? Or is the outbreak making people question this more?
It's always a complexity. Some people say, this is a time when people should not complain, but work together. And all opinions nobody in the world cares about Chinese people more than Chinese government. It's not like always black and white. And some people are quite struggling with the censorship, but the other people, it seems like the censorship has not nothing to do with them, but not much to do with them. So people who have been struggling with censorship, especially last week when the doctor Li Wenliang, who first broke the news, he died from the virus. All my social media feeding was people questioning the system, questioning the government, and asking for more investigation, asking for changes. Some of my friends say, well, maybe this is a moment when something will change, there will be more people being inspired to challenge the system, challenge how the censorship work. But just after like one day or two, like this kind of discussion just died down. And it really reminds me of several times in the past. It's not the first time in China when people get angry and certain things and then asking for changes and get really angry with the system. So, for example, in 2011, so when the fast train, the bullet train, there was an accident, there was a clash of the train, the fast train, many people, all middle-class Chinese died. And was quite, in a way, quite similar to today's virus. And then people are questioning about the system via the CCP and how the officials work. And they're asking for changes, and journalists get angry and ask for changes, do more investigative work. But then just within like weeks, people still get back to normal, you know. So I don't know if I should be optimistic, because I have seen this like a circle going again and again and again.
That was Beijing-based journalist Caroline Kan. The restlessness and mundanity of life under lockdown that she described was a common experience throughout most of the world as more and more countries began imposing movement restrictions in the first half of the year. Indonesia seemed to have avoided this economically devastating path as few cases were detected in the country. That situation changed in July, however, as the number of new cases per day spiraled into the thousands. The fight against COVID-19 was complicated further by the spread of conspiracy theories in Indonesia. Yohanes Nugroho, a journalist in Surabaya, spoke to us about this in August. And turning to the issue of COVID-19 conspiracy theories, which you mentioned earlier, I have to say I was surprised to learn that these kinds of theories have gained quite a lot of traction in Indonesia. And you wrote about this in a recent article for The New Narrative. So why do so many Indonesians believe in COVID-19 conspiracy theories?
Well, I think one of the issues is that people really don't trust the government. I mean, this is true because people in Indonesia have always believed that the government is telling them less than it should be, you know, telling them. So in a way, it's understandable. I mean, this has a long history, basically, going off the track. For example, in the 90s, when President Suharto was still in power, you know, when his wife died in 1996, I think, the official version was that she died of a heart attack. But then people started coming up with conspiracy theories, you know, oh, no, she died in a firefight, you know, because she was trying to come between the two sons who were shooting at one another, things like that. So people, Indonesians always believe there's something more to whatever the government is saying, you know, that they're being lied to or something. I mean, that's the whole, the general mentality anyway.
What are some of these theories being bandied about and how widespread are they?
Well, it's pretty common. I think if we're talking about class divide, then the lower middle class and the lower classes believe in the conspiracy theories more, I think, because, you know, they're not seeing any government action that's helping them. Many live sort of hand to mouth. You know, they can't really earn if they don't work. And if there's a lockdown, of course, they can't work. So that's the reality. Many people in Indonesia believe that the COVID-19 epidemic was a sort of a conspiracy by big companies, you know, to squeeze more money out of the people. And in a way, it's also, it doesn't help that the health industry is, it has a really bad image, bad public image, because the general idea among the people, if you go to a hospital, then they're going to bleed you dry. I mean, it's true in many cases. I mean, I've had experiences myself, you know, when if you have to be hospitalized, especially in a private hospital, they will try to basically inflate the size of your bill, you know, even by getting you to do unnecessary tests and unnecessary therapies. So the health sector in Indonesia has a bad image and people don't really believe it. That's why people don't really want to go to the hospital unless it's the last resort for them, you know, it's the last thing they could do.
That was Indonesian writer Yohanes Nugroho. We'll have more highlights from Pressing Matters in 2020 after these messages. Stay with us, BFM 89.9. Thanks for staying with us. This is Pressing Matters on the Morning Run. I'm Shazana, and today we're looking back at some of the conversations we've had with journalists around the region in the year of COVID-19. As countries grappled to control the spread of the virus, the conduct of elections became a topic of hot debate. While some governments, such as in Hong Kong and New Zealand, opted to delay their elections until the virus situation was brought under control, the Singapore government made the surprise decision to hold elections even as daily cases were increasing among its migrant worker community. In July, Singaporean journalist Kirsten Han spoke to us about the controversy around holding the elections as well as the eventual outcome. Let's dive into those elections, which took place on Friday. So the elections were called almost a year before Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong's term was due to end. And a lot of eyebrows were raised because the timing was, after all, smack in the midst of the pandemic. Prime Minister Lee said this was in order for his government to get a strong mandate to make difficult decisions in the face of the COVID-19 fallout. But you've written that you're not quite convinced about this rationale. So why is the timing of the elections problematic?
So, I mean, firstly, it's just dangerous to have, you know, elections in the middle of a pandemic. And even now, Singapore's daily reported cases are in three digits, you know, the lower three digits, but that's still a lot. And, you know, they say that, oh, you know, a lot of these cases are in migrant worker dormitories and not actually circulating among the population outside. But, you know, it's still significant that there are these cases and that, you know, the government and the civil service should be focused on dealing with this situation, not having to campaign and be trained as presiding officers for polling stations and counting centers and things like that. So it was just very contradictory to hear the government say things like, oh, it's not safe enough for us to be able to have social gatherings of more than 10 people, and we need to be very careful and have a phased opening from lockdown. And then at the same time say, okay, now all of you go to a polling station and vote, or, you know, have walkabouts in hawker centers and things like that. One of the justifications was, oh, you know, other countries have had elections. And that's true, you know, South Korea did have elections. But the point in Singapore was that we did not need to have the election now. You know, it wouldn't have triggered a constitutional crisis or something to not have an election now. And there was no indication that Singaporeans felt like they didn't already have a strong mandate to deal with the crisis. So the reasoning for why we should have an election at this point in time was already questionable.
So, Kirsten, you wrote about bracing for an opposition wipeout as the worst case scenario. What do you make of the outcome then, where the ruling party PAP won, but by a smaller majority than hoped for?
So there was a lot of worry from opposition parties of an opposition wipeout. And I think those were, you know, justifiable fears, because going into the election, it seemed like so many things were in the PAP's favor. You know, they got to choose the timing, so they were the only parties that were forewarned. It's a pandemic, which led people to expect that that would be a sort of flight to safety mentality among the voters. The PAP government had just announced four consecutive budgets amounting to an eye-watering amount of money to help Singaporeans tide over COVID and deal with the crisis. And then, you know, with no physical rallies, which were previously a big venue for opposition parties to mobilize supporters and fundraise. And then so there was a lot of fear that the results in 2015, when we saw 70% of the vote go to the PAP and the opposition just clinging on to their seats by smaller margins than before, there was a fear that this would be extended and there would be basically 100% PAP parliament with no opposition elected. So to see that that didn't happen is a relief for Singaporeans who want a more competitive democracy. And I think the results show that, you know, the flight to safety didn't quite work out in the way the PAP might have expected, and that Singaporeans are now more politically aware, but also have different expectations of their politics. You know, they don't just want stability or the semblance of stability. They also want diversity, and they also want to see politics conducted in a way that's fair.
That was journalist Kirsten Han. In other election news, the U.S. elections were, of course, the center of global attention in early November. But closer to home, Myanmar was also conducting national democratic elections around the same time. We spoke to Andrew Nakamson, a journalist based in Yangon, on Myanmar's fledgling steps towards democracy and the obstacles in its path. This is only Myanmar's second democratic election. So back in 2015, the party led by Aung San Suu Kyi, the National League for Democracy, or the NLD, earned a landslide victory to much fanfare, both locally and abroad. But the 2020 elections are definitely not being seen in the same light as 2015. Why is that?
Yeah, so I think in 2015, there were a lot of the same problems that there are now. But there was a general sense of excitement. It was the first election where the NLD was participating and was widely expected to win. I mean, they participated in 1990, but then the election was annulled. So 2015 had this real sense of optimism, and people were critical of certain aspects of the election, but that criticism fell on the USDP and the military. Now in 2020, the NLD is doing a lot of the same things that the USDP did, but they're not receiving the same amount of criticism from Western countries. They are from journalists and analysts, but the West has been relatively silent. And among those issues, one of the biggest ones and one of the most disappointing has been the censorship of opposition parties. So opposition parties, when they present their party platform on state media, have not been allowed to be critical of the government and have been censored in some ways that really don't even make sense. Like the Arakan National Party was not allowed to talk about voter disinterest in Rakhine. Mm-hmm. That was struck from the record. Another smaller party tried to talk about children's rights issues and was not allowed to speak about that. Hmm. And the NLD hasn't really said anything about it. Another similar issue, there was a small but growing movement of boycotters who basically said that it's impossible to hold a free and fair election in Myanmar under the 2008 constitution, mm-hmm. which a lot of people agree with because that's the constitution that guarantees the military 25% of the seats in parliament and requires more than 75% to change the constitution. So it's this catch-22. And the NLD responded really aggressively and really angrily towards the boycotters, basically telling them, you know, we fought for the right to vote. How dare you not exercise it? And the UEC was threatening to arrest people, even though there's nothing in the election laws that actually say you can't boycott. And even though the NLD boycotted the 2010 election for the exact same reason that they didn't trust the 2008 constitution. So it just seems like the NLD has kind of lost sight of some of its pro-democracy roots and has allowed the political system to kind of change them more than people were expecting.
That was journalist Andrew Nakamson. Finally, a concerning trend that we'll be watching in the coming year is the long-term effects of the pandemic on global media freedoms, which have continued to come under attack around the world. In the Philippines, the state of its independent media caught global attention when well-known journalist and founder of the online news portal Rappler, Maria Ressa, was convicted of cyber libel. Back in June, we spoke to Danilo Arau, Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Philippines, on the reactions to the case. So within this media landscape then, where does Rappler stand? How large a following does it have? Who is its primary audience? And I guess, how does it compare to the following of other media outlets in the Philippines?
Well, for those who may not be aware, Rappler was established in 2010. So it's only about 10 years old. So it's relatively new. But what's interesting about Rappler, even if it's fairly young, it's one of the most popular websites or digital platform in the country right now. So that would partly explain why it's the logical target of the Duterte administration. I'm sure you've heard of the closure of the leading network, ABS-CBN, last May 5 when its franchise expired. Because in the Philippines, you need a broadcast franchise approved by Congress to continue broadcasting. So ABS-CBN was denied that. So ABS-CBN, just to put it in perspective, it's the leading TV and radio network in the country. And then you have also Rappler, on the other hand, which is one of the leading websites in the country. So they are logical targets because insofar as chilling effect is concerned, the Duterte administration is sending a clear message that if we can do this to the leading news media organizations in the country, it can happen to other news media organizations unless they toe the line.
We know that the decision has garnered a lot of attention and criticism from international observers around the world. And this is no surprise given Maria Ressa's long career and standing in the global media industry. She's very well known. She was a Time Person of the Year in 2018. So, of course, there's a lot of people abroad watching this case. But what is the discourse coming out from the Filipino public? How are they seeing it?
Of course, the outrage is there, but if you want to be very objective about it, it's a very polarizing issue. Polarizing in the sense that we cannot deny the fact that the president, despite his authoritarian tendencies, he still gets relatively high approval ratings. So in the process, there are people who support the policies of the Duterte administration. So we have to be open to that. Now, there is really, understandably, outrage given, as you correctly mentioned, the standing of Maria Ressa. But what I have to stress here is that Maria is just one of the many cases of harassment and intimidation. I can tell you right now that in the alternative media, red baiting is an everyday reality. When I say red baiting, there are accusations of some of our alternative media practitioners being communists or being sympathizers of communists. And because when you are accused of being a communist here in the Philippines, you become fair game to arrest, detention, or even summary execution. So that's the problem with the polarizing effect. So we are trying our best here in the Philippines to win over people so that they can really look at the truth behind the repression that is happening right now.
That was journalism professor and journalist Danilo Arau. That's all the time we have on Pressing Matters this week. You can catch all of the conversations featured today and the many more we've had on podcast. Search for Pressing Matters on our website, the BFM app, or on Spotify for the full list. Thank you for listening, and we hope that you continue to join us for more compelling conversations in the new year. Up next is the 10 a.m. News Bulletin, followed by Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.